Death is something that ultimately affects all of us, but we don't talk about it very much. Well, that's going to change this hour. Good afternoon. John Munson in for Ben Marins today on At Issue. And this hour, we're going to talk about death and why we don't talk about it and how our ideas about death have changed over time. Our attitudes about death have changed over time. We create bucket lists now. We spend time designing cemeteries. And we're going to talk about the role of religion in all of this as well. My guest is Albert Hampshire, Kenneth S. Davis Professor of History at Kansas State University, where he teaches the course Death and Dying in History, a course he developed. Professor Hampshire, welcome to At Issue.
Thank you for having me on.
Why don't we talk about death more? What is it about death that makes it so difficult for us to speak of it? I mean, it's like birth. It's something that happens to everyone.
Well, I think part of it is just the nature of modern times in the broadest sense. If posit the following things briefly, I mean, if we live in a society that values fun and material pleasure, well, I can't think of anything that puts more of a crimp in that. I think we're also separated by demographic realities as well, because whereas in the past, back in the day, so to speak, death cut through the entire demographic pyramid, nowadays it's confined to the elderly who have, quote, retired from, quote, productive life. And death often occurs in institutional settings, hospitals, nursing homes, and the like. And most of us can go through a good chunk of our adult life without confronting it. And you don't confront something, there's a certain mystery about it, and mystery can be a source of anxiety. I think medicine is important as well. I mean, we all know the benefits of medical science, and how many of us wouldn't be here if we hadn't been born 100 years ago. But the flip side, every verse, every recto has a verso, every coin has its flip side. And death can, the technology that we now have available gives an assurance that maybe medicine can bail us out. And death becomes frightening in those circumstances. It becomes almost useless and inexplicable. We can put a man on the moon, so why can't we, you know, solve some problems relating to our own death? And so I think that's an issue as well. There's a whole checklist of things one could run through, but the whole momentum of modern culture is to isolate us from death. And if you don't have to confront something, it's not easily understood and can be a source of considerable anxiety.
You teach a course, Death and Dying in History. It's a course you developed. What prompted you to develop that class?
Well, students did. When I teach, this is way back in the day, in the mid-70s, when I was teaching some Western Civ courses, I always want to expose students to something besides guns and drums, or the Brits would put it, chaps and maps, and to think outside the box a little bit. And at that time, a French historian by the name of Philippe Ariès published a series of lectures called Western Attitudes Towards Death from the Middle Ages to the Present, and I had these youngsters read it, and a few of them said to me, gee, this stuff is really cool, why don't we work up a course on this? Well, sooner, easier said than done. Yeah, I'll just work up a course. But I took the bait, and I said, okay, let's work up something. And I've been teaching that course for about 35 years, moving things around, you know, changing books, changing approaches and whatnot as one matures over in life. But it was actually the students who got me started on all of that. And then about 8 years or so ago, I said to myself, wait a minute, I've been teaching this thing now for 30 years or 25, 30 years. I should begin to publish in it. And so I kind of adopted it as a second field in which I work. My, quote, day job, unquote, field is early modern France in the 17th and 18th century on things judicial and administrative and financial. It's pretty far removed from the death and dying. So it adds a nice little balance to my life, too, that I can go back and forth between these things.
How has teaching, developing and teaching this course changed your own attitude toward death or your own ideas about it, if it has?
Well, I don't know. As you well know, we're all going to have to confront this someday. And it's Sigmund Freud once said, if we really recognize the reality of our own impending death, we'd all go insane. So it's always the other person, and we always consider ourselves lucky it hasn't hit us yet. But I think as a historian, one is conditioned to accept this anyway, because, I mean, if you really think about it, history is the study, mostly, except for very modern topics, history is the study of people who are deceased. And so historians are around death all the time. But one can never say one's not frightened of the prospect of death. There's always that anxiety. But I think it'll be a lot easier for me to leave the mortal coil, because I've been dealing with this subject.
Mm-hmm. What about your students?
It's not alien to me.
Okay. Chances are most of your students don't have a lot of direct experience with death. Why aren't they reluctant to talk about the topic? Or maybe they are. Maybe there is some issue with that with students in the class. Tell me about that.
Well, we kind of come already a little bit of a full circle. I mean, if one is not exposed to this and one doesn't discuss it a lot, it leads to a certain curiosity about it. And I think a number of students come into this course thinking, well, this is weird. Let's go take a look at this, and think this is going to be some funky little jaunt down memory lane. But this is actually the most difficult course I teach, because there's demand for it. And I require at least a book or an equivalent of a book a week in this course. And after 3 or 4 weeks, they bear down very seriously and take the subject seriously. Now, I have to remind them, don't become obsessed with it. You're young people, please. But at least recognize these things and understand that death and attitudes and practices surrounding death are a gateway in understanding the values of a culture in any given time. Death encapsulates all of our hopes and aspirations, anxieties, and fears. And the study of death can tell us a great deal about the current state of a civilization at any point, and what people value and don't value. So it's a window onto larger questions. It's not just the subject itself, but it's a different way of viewing the way people behave historically.
Well, it's certainly true. I mean, when you go back far enough, mostly what we have to look at is the rituals that we can discover, the things that the people thought were important about life and death. And we look at tombs, we look at the way people were buried, we look at how the dead were treated, revered or written about, or even in some cases probably worshipped. We can look at that, and because that's what we have to look at, that's the record. How has that look look back that you give to your students as when you take them through kind of the history of this? Do they have any kind of aha moments where they suddenly start to understand what it really means, and maybe give a perspective of our own contemporary period here and our own attitudes toward death?
Well, I think that's really an interesting way to put it. An aha moment, and I think one aha moment is when I'll show them our local cemetery here, and we have records that go back to the mid 19th century, and registers the people who died, and in columns in these registers of where do they come from, which is interesting also. From what did they die? Where are they buried? How old were they? And that's where the first aha moment comes, is where they go down those registers and then go out to the cemetery itself, and they see that the majority of burials in any given year were young children and infants. And that, I think, shocks them a little bit. And they begin then to understand how people couldn't avoid death in those days. They had to deal with it on a daily reality, particularly with meager medical facilities and physicians and not a lot of the professional funeral people. People had to wrestle with it themselves, roll up their sleeves and deal with it on a daily basis, and often in their families. I mean, if you were to go to the mid-19th century, it's imagine a family of four. Before the age of 15, a child would have seen a brother or a sister or a parent, or certainly grandparents, die. So they would have been exposed to it at a very early age. And so when you walk through a cemetery and just look at the dates of birth and death dates of the people there, and then walk through the cemetery, taking a walk through time up into the modern era, that creates a an aha moment.
Okay. I'd like to I'd like to get some of our listeners involved in this conversation. We're talking about death and we don't like to talk about it. Our attitudes perhaps have changed over time as we have less experience on a day-to-day basis of death than people who lived 100 or 150 years ago. And maybe because of that insulation, that changes our attitudes and the way we think. I'd like to know how this strikes you. What are your views on death and dying? Obviously, we all have to face it at some point, or we should. So do you feel comfortable discussing death? Would you rather avoid the topic? How can we have a more honest conversation about this particular subject? Here's how you can get in touch with us. 800-642-1234 is a toll-free number. It should be good pretty much anywhere you can hear the program. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find At Issue with Ben Marins on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. We're talking about death and our attitudes about it, our ideas about it, the fact that we don't like to talk about it particularly. It's one of those subjects that doesn't come up too often at the dinner table, for example. What do you think? 800-642-1234. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Professor Hampshire and hopefully your calls as well. I'm John Munson in for Ben Marins today on At Issue. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're listening to At Issue on the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Ben Marins today. Ben, a little under the weather. Hopefully, he'll be healthy enough to return to work tomorrow. But you get me today. And in this hour, we're talking about death and our attitudes toward it and how we don't often like to talk about it. It's not a very pleasant subject. Considering one's own end or the end of life of a loved one or a friend. We're talking about that today. My guest is Albert Hampshire, Kenneth S. Davis Professor of History at Kansas State University, where he teaches a course, Death and Dying in History, which he developed in response to student demand. They wanted to know about it, and so he's been teaching it for over 30 years. We're starting to get some phone calls. We'll go to those in just a moment. But first, a couple more questions for me, Professor. Out of sight, out of mind is one way to put it. I mean, we warehouse our elderly in rest homes. We go and visit them on Sundays. And in the rest of the week, we can keep them safely tucked away. And we don't have to confront the fact that these are people who are probably going to shuffle off this mortal coil fairly soon. We're just really uncomfortable with the whole messy business of people dying, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Bob, please call me Al.
Okay.
It's a messy situation, particularly if we're unschooled on how to behave. I think things are changing a little bit. We've got some positive things going on, like the hospice movement, a more humane way of going out. People have the chance to die at home, surrounded by family members, or at least in a hospice situation that's certainly more welcoming than a sterile hospital environment where others set the rules. The very fact we're talking about this on your show, I bet when 30 years ago, if somebody suggested you would have somebody like me on, you might have said, I'm not going to get into a morbid thing like that, you know. So, I mean, there are some positive developments going on. I think this death avoidance, quite frankly, is the blip on the radar screen. People have been dealing with death and coming to terms with it and discussing it for a very long time. And it's just, I think, these unique circumstances of the 20th century that helped reverse that. But I think we're going to return to a more open way of dealing with this subject. So I think that we're in an era of deviation, but I think we're coming out of it.
Okay. Well, we have some callers lined up. Let's go to Milwaukee first and hear from Joan. Joan, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Here I am. I'm 79.
Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Hi. When I was a freshman in college in 1950, I'm only 79 now, there was a send-up of the American funeral business, and it was called The Loved One. And it showed like a mummy wrapped in. Well, we imitated it. We thought it was really great, and I'm going to go and get it again because it was a comedy about the American way of burying people. And I can't remember the name of the author.
Evelyn Waugh, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it was a comedy, unless I couldn't read.
Kind of a morbid comedy. They're making fun of Forest Lawn, if I recall. Remember Johnny Carson used to make fun of that place?
Oh, yeah.
Which is the Memorial Park with the flat headstones and whatnot. So, yeah, it was a dark comedy. It was very funny.
Well, my name was Murphy before I got married, so I guess I'm a dark Irish sort of person. That was
one thing. Just don't get obsessed with it. You got plenty of years left.
When I drove like mad around the edges of South Dakota one year and crossed over into North Dakota to try to find where somebody was living that I was supposed to meet up with. And I walked through a cemetery, and it was like babies and babies and more babies.
Yeah.
And you even had to wonder if maybe they buried their babies in the, it was a Catholic cemetery, I think. But maybe the older people got burned on a pyre like the Sioux were prone to do out there.
No, I actually think that what you're confronting there is the reality. Child mortality was really wicked back in the day. That's why demographers will often, when they calculate life expectancies and whatnot, they'll do one set of calculations from birth, another set of calculations from, say, the age 15, because if one could survive all the childhood diseases and live to the age of 15 or 16, one had a pretty good chance of having a life expectancy not as high as it is now, but by no means even unreasonable by our own standards. But the families had to confront this problem all the time because of an absence of medical services. Periodically I'll say to my class, I'll say, well, there's 35 of you in here. Now, 100 years ago, I'd only be talking to 15 of you because the other 15 wouldn't have made it this far.
Mm-hmm. What about Joan's idea of using, she started by talking about a book that was morbidly humorous about death, that may kind of sending up Forest Lawn. We often use humor to deal with unpleasant topics like death. How common is that? We use humor to deal with unpleasant topics generally. How common is it that we use it to deal with topics like death?
As a historian, I'm not as wired into contemporary culture as maybe I should be. I kind of live in the past. But, even if you're at a time and place where death is present all the time and one is compelled to accept it, it doesn't mean that people welcome it. I mean, it's still a source of anxiety. And one way to relieve tension on any touchy subject is through humor. I mean, my favorite line is one of old Red Fox when he said, "Well, you got to die of something." I always got a big kick out of that. You know? it's a natural kind of thing to make light of something. It helps reduce the burden to it.
The British satirist Terry Pratchett actually has a character in one of his series of books, Death. And the basically describes it as sort of the anthropomorphization of the concept of death into this person with the black hooded robe and the scythe and the bony visage. And it's one of his more popular characters, but he uses that to kind of poke fun at the human condition and some of our attitudes. And I'm sure that there have been other writers who did the same through history. If there's something out there, somebody will poke fun of it. Let's try to get another call in before the news. We'll go to Evanston, Illinois, and hear from Jerry next. Jerry, good afternoon.
How do you do? I thought I'd mention that we're coming back from a 1850 cemetery in my family cemetery from when my great-great-grandfather homesteaded. And we're both in our, my wife and I, in our 70s. And we decided last year to put a monument for ourselves, our children, to bury us up there. And while digging the foundation for the monument, the concrete expert came up with some bones. Bones of what we gauged to be an infant and a child under 2 years old. We were talking about 19th century death and all of these homesteaders with their little children all in one bedroom and dying common deaths. And so what happened is these two children in an unmarked grave in Wisconsin must have died of a common shared illness. So I thought to myself, well, I've got 32 graves in that cemetery, and maybe I better have them all checked to see if there are any other unmarked graves, because all of them date to the 19th century, and there were a lot of deaths back then. And so I called in a ground-penetrating radar expert who came in about June, and he found nine of them on my cemetery plots. And we are now on our way back from the cemetery where this past 3 days we placed markers for all nine of these unmarked graves that just say, here lie the remains of a person known only to God, because they're all over 100 years old.
Jerry, thank you for your insights. We need to go for news, and Al, we'll get your comments about what Jerry had to say after the news. We're talking about death. It's something we don't like to talk about, but we're devoting an hour of radio time to it this afternoon, wondering what you think. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find us on Facebook. I'm John Munson, in for Ben Marins. You're listening to At Issue, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 3:35. You're listening to At Issue on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Ben Marins this afternoon. In this hour, we're talking about something we don't like to talk about, death and our attitudes, our ideas about it. My guest has developed a course at Kansas State University called Death and Dying in History. He's Albert Hampshire, Kenneth S. Davis Professor of History at Kansas State in Manhattan, Kansas. By the way, I should get extra points for knowing where that is. I've actually been on that campus. My wife has cousins who live in Manhattan, and we visit them regularly. Before the news, Jerry was on, and he was talking about they had a family cemetery. Family cemeteries used to be very, very common. Obviously, they're not common anymore. One of the changes that we've made in dealing with death is we just don't have those kinds of things, and their cemeteries are regulated and so forth. But he talked about a family cemetery and what they recently discovered there, and probably not an uncommon occurrence.
By the way, I just wanted to say that Jerry's a very kind and gracious man. I mean, to put up markers like that. A number of circumstances could have resulted. I mean, remember back in the day, people didn't have a lot of disposable income, and they might have not marked a grave not because they didn't care, but because they just didn't have the wherewithal to do it, or maybe they used a wooden marker that's now disappeared and whatnot. But what is kind of interesting is that I said the aha moment was when people discover all of these children and infants and whatnot, and all the calls so far have been people who've experienced that aha moment when they were themselves walking through a cemetery. So I kind of like that. Keep it up. I feel vindicated. But I was wondering, a little dark humor, Jerry. I'm saying, well, Jerry, when they bury you, you'll be in good company. There we go.
There we go. All right. We've got full phone banks, so let's go to the phones. And Lynn and Eau Claire, you'll be first. Lynn, thanks for staying with us here during the news.
Good afternoon, John and guest. I would like to, discuss the role of the living in the act of dying. My husband and I went to visit an uncle in a nursing home where he and his wife were residents. We got up there. We knew he was very bad. When we got there, he was in the dying process. And then something just took over. I said, bring his wife in. His wife has Alzheimer's, and no one has seen nor heard her, seen her eyes nor heard from her for about 5 years. And I, just intuitively, I bridged, put my left hand on her shoulder, and I touched his right shoulder. And she snapped. She opened her eyes. She cried. She said a few words to her sister, who is my mother-in-law. It was amazing. I felt the uncle relax. We made promises. The wife said thank you to the young man, called him by name, that brought her down to say goodbye to her husband. And this is not something I've ever done before, nor do I know why it happened, but it happened, and it changed my idea about dying. And I'm not
how
afraid.
So? How did it change it, Lynn?
If the living are part of it, if you respect the couple as still a couple, and there's some involvement where you, my mother was alone. We got a call after she died. It's they're still part of the family there, mm-hmm. And it was beautiful. It was frightening and it was unnerving. But when you look back at it, it was beautiful. They got to say their goodbyes. And then when we are honor bound to keep the promises we made.
Lynn brings up a great question. What is the role of the living at the bedside of the dying? And how important has closure, that kind of closure, been historically?
Well, I think historically, I think that what Lynn is saying was the general rule, again, until very modern times. In recent, say the last 80 years, we've entered into this very strange relationship between the living and the dead. On the one hand, the living don't want their loved ones to depart, and so instead of saying, look, this could lead to death, we'll be all right, we'll try some more medicine, everything will be okay. And the dying person doesn't want to distress loved ones, and okay, let's fight the good fight. Then nobody really comes to terms with this thing until the bitter end, and everybody can be miserable. So I think the story that Lynn tells, we could beam her back 200 years, and I think she'd find a lot of that. And too often we've gotten away from that, and I would hope that we can reconstruct that kind of relationship.
Okay.
That was a very interesting story. I really appreciate that, Lynn.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Let's go to Barbara in Superior next. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, hello. Lynn's story was eloquently told. I have no fear about the moments before death. It's the dying process, watching somebody that we love deteriorate. But there is that moment where that person leaves this earth, and it's a release for him or her, and for a family member to be there with them is so very important. Death itself can be a release. Who knows, what's out there. But the dying process before death is very difficult, I think, for people.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Barbara. That's something that's probably changed quite a bit over time. It takes people longer to die these days, perhaps because of the advances we've made in medicine. In 150 years ago, there were the diseases that killed much faster.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you start bringing modern medicine into this and refuse to turn off the machine and whatnot, yeah, I mean it just drags out and adds to a lot of the stress. There's no question about it. I mean, I was going through your archives, and you had someone on 3 or 4 weeks ago that you interviewed, didn't you, about death, trying to extract death from a purely medical context?
Yeah, that would have been Ben, whose regular show this is. I'm the fill-in, but the producers assure me that we did indeed have the show,
Ben,
as you suggest.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting hour. Talking
at
about
issue was like, always an interesting hour, but...
But, yeah, that dying is harder in modern times. Let's put it that way. It just is.
Okay.
There's a reluctance to let go, and then if you start bringing in all the machines and all the advances of modern technology, these things can take a very long time, especially when you're dealing with diseases that are rather gradual to begin with, like cancer, for example.
Mm-hmm. A term that's cropped up in our lexicon in just the last couple of years is bucket list. Where did this term come from, and how has it influenced the conversation about death?
Well, I've got a lot of I won't go on a long thing here, but I've got very ambivalent feelings about it. It comes from a movie in 2007 that had Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson, two men who had terminal diseases, and they went on and on and on what they would like to do before they, quote, kick the bucket, thus a bucket list. Now, on one level, I think it's fine, because people at least recognize that I'm going to die and what would I like to do, but the responses are almost thoroughly secular in nature, focused on the here and now. When you look at these bucket lists that people prepare on the internet and whatnot, you'll find very few people who say, well, my bucket list is to go to a monastery in Quebec and ponder the act of death and its aftermath, or I'll do the same in a temple in the Himalayas. Instead, it's this modern fixation with doing things in a material way. Climb a volcano, I've seen. Perfect a chili recipe, play the oboe, visit New Zealand, get a tattoo, all that kind of stuff. And so in a curious way, it's death avoidance. You see, I'm going to die, but it's not much discussion about the act of death and the aftermath of it. So in that sense, it still reflects our anxiety about death itself. And another thing that strikes me is only people in a very prosperous society can contemplate these bucket lists. I mean, I guarantee you that a peasant in 14th century Peru, or the region of Peru, or some poor person, in the midst of the civil war in the Congo, is going to make a bucket list. If they have a bucket list of one item on it, which is dinner.
Mm-hmm.
See.
So, by the way,
I find this whole thing. I have very ambiguous feelings about it. It's a recognition of death, but it's in such a way that I don't think there's much movement out towards a more healthy, a healthier view of death itself and a contemplation about what's next after death.
By the way, the program Al was referring to was from Thursday, August 2nd, and if you missed it, you can go to WPR.org and hear an archived version of the program. Ben talked with Stephen Kiernan about rescuing end of life from the medical system. So that Thursday, August 2nd. And by the way, At Issue, like all the other programs on the Ideas Network, is archived for your later listening pleasure. And you can go to WPR.org and find out all about that. This hour, we're talking about death again, twice in 1 month. We're bookending the month with discussions of death and talking about how attitudes and ideas about death have changed over time. And Al, when we come back, there's one thing I alluded to this earlier, but I didn't follow up on it, and now I'm kicking myself. Before we go back to the phones, I want to get your take on this idea of we've got this fixture, this death, as this hooded figure holding the scythe, which is an instrument of harvest, and the relationship between that idea of harvest and death. I'd like to get your take on that. We'll do that when we come back. We're going to take a short break. I'm John Munson, in for Ben Marins. The program is At Issue. You're listening to it on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 3:48. You're listening to At Issue on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 3, From the first Earth Day to the Great Peshtigo Fire and so much more, Ben and his guest will delve into Wisconsin's rich history tomorrow after 3 o'clock. And then, of course, tomorrow at 4, it's Your Views on the News. A lot more coming up tomorrow on At Issue. This hour, we're talking about death. And my guest is Al Hampshire, Kenneth S. Davis, Professor of History at Kansas State University, where he teaches a course, Death and Dying in History, that he developed based on student demand. All right, now, Al, I want to hear about the Grim Reaper. Where do we get that, and what's the significance?
Well, I don't know how far back we can go, but I can think of something Americans would appreciate. If you take a look at tombstones in Puritan New England, go back into the 17th and early 18th century, it's a common motif. Imagine in your mind a globe, the world, with a flame on it, and on one side there would be death as a skeleton, putting the flame out with a cap, and on the other side is Father Time, often holding a sieve, as well as an hourglass. The time runs out. And I think part of this business with Grim Reaper, I mean, this might sound very simplistic, forgive me for it, but I think it comes from when we lived in predominantly agrarian societies and people were used to agricultural images. And a harvest comes along, and then that harvest is, you reap the harvest, and it's time for the next one to come. And it's very easy to transpose that over to thinking in terms of generations.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I was curious about that, and now I've got notes, so if there's a quiz, I can pass. Let's go to Janet in Brookfield next. Hi, Janet.
Hi, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have 2 points. I'd like to address the most simple one first, and that is the idea of a green or natural burial. I myself have arranged for mine already, and in these hard economic times, for me, it makes sense. I was raised Catholic, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and, you know, there, you know, in this case, and it is available in Milwaukee and in Waukesha, and there, it's beautiful. If you go to the cemetery and you see the areas that are blocked off for green burials, it's all Wisconsin native flowers and grasses and trees, and you can pick out your own spot. It's very inexpensive, and the only thing is you have to be completely biodegradable. So if you wear earrings, no metal. If you want to wear your wedding dress, you have to take the zipper off. There's no embalmment, you know, there's no bloodletting or anything like that. And of course, it has to be done probably within 24 to 48 hours. You have to plan ahead for it so that you'll be taken from the place of death to a funeral home, which will then transport you to the place of the burial, and then you can have your ceremony planned with your family. The hole will already be dug, and you can be shrouded in the fanciest prom dress you ever had, your wedding dress, or, you know, your fuzziest robe, whatever you like, and then placed inside another container, which, you know, if, you know, somebody loves you that much, they could weave you a coffin, something like the Egyptians used to do, mm-hmm. or a plain pine box like they did in the Western days.
We're running short of time here, Janet, and I want to get Al's response to this.
Well, I had a technical question, but we probably won't get to it, and that is, if everything has to be biodegradable, what do you do with pacemakers and hip joint replacements and whatnot? So I assume that the funeral director would
would have to do something to remove those things. But on to the larger thing, yeah. But Janet, you are a nightmare for the traditional funeral industry, much of which relies on fancy and heavy caskets and all of that. But you're on the cutting edge, and I think the funeral industry is adapting itself to that. With scattering of ashes and green burials. I mean, more and more one's beginning to see this. But see, this is what I was saying a little bit earlier. This death anxiety that we've had, is the blip on the radar screen. The way that Janet was describing things is not uncommon going all the way back to the Middle Ages, and it seems strange now, but we're only reinventing the wheel. We're not inventing the wheel. We're going back to the way things were before this hiatus of about a century when we got away from it. So Janet can take solace in the fact that she's going to be joining countless generation of ancestors that preceded her prior to the 20th century.
What about the role of religion in death? I mean, that's always been pretty critical.
Well, how much time do we have there? we don't have much time left.
Take about 2 minutes. I want to get to one more call.
The big picture. I mean,
give me the Cliff's Notes version.
Okay, the Cliff Note version, three sentences. As you well know, the religion can be a source of anxiety. Just think of the prospect of hell and punishment and all of that. Take that as a given. But on the other hand, religion can be a great source of reassurance. It does answer big questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What can I do, if anything, about where I'm going? It provides an anchor of sorts. I mean, it gives us a grounding, religion does. It's a double-sided coin. It can be a source of anxiety, but a great source of reassurance as well. And studies by sociologists have shown that people who have deep religious convictions seem to die a bit easier. Mm-hmm. But who knows ultimately what's in the mind of a person who's dying. But people who have religious convictions seem to accept it and deal with it better than those who feel kind of helpless in the world.
Let's take a call from Steele in Appleton next. Steele, good afternoon.
Hey, Al. I'd love to listen to your class. I love your third world bucket list. What's for lunch? I was just curious what you've seen over the different G8 cultures that, you know, have money and how they treat the dying. I've heard in California you can watch a video on a tombstone. And like you said, well, I was going to ask about other cultures, that would be forever how they treat the people. But the cultures that have big bucket lists and can afford each one. My father was stationed in Germany, and I remember walking in German graveyards, and I love graveyards too. You'd see candles at night, and anyway, I appreciate this conversation.
All right, Steele, thanks.
Thanks.
Modern and industrial funerals.
Well, so the name of the game these days in everything, whether it be in markers or even in caskets, is personalization. Everything has to be personalized. This is the way things are these days. And sometimes it takes very strange forms. You know, when you go up to a bank window and the teller will push out not a bucket, you know, a bucket list I have online.
Right.
And you drop your money and they pull it back in a drawer. They push out a drawer.
Right.
Well, at one point there in California, there were a couple of funeral homes where you could drive up in your car. This is convenience for a car society. And the embalmed body would be pushed out of a door at the funeral home and out the window there, and you could take a look at it and then drive off, you know. But these,
oh my God!
I know these things are aberrations. I mean, you're one's always going to find funky things. I mean, when I approach this as a historian, I'm less concerned about funky things because you're always going to find those in all times and all places. But what most people are doing most of the time. Somebody wants to find culture is repetitive behavior, and I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're going to see crazy things like this. But they'll calm down, and I think that Janet, what she's talking about, is a more sane approach that we're going to see coming along. Rather than some of the things Steele was talking about.
Speaking of repetitive behavior, the show comes to an end at the end of every hour. So we'll repeat that behavior here, and we're out of time, Professor. I appreciate you being with us today.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much.
Al Hampshire is Kenneth S. Davis Professor of History at Kansas State University, where he teaches the course Death and Dying in History, a course he developed. You can go back and listen to the program again if you missed any of it. Just go to WPR.org and click on over to the At Issue page, and you'll find it there. Cynthia Schuster handled on-air production. Chris Molina produced this program. I'm John Munson, and for Ben Marins, it's At Issue on the Ideas Network of WPR.